Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Alright, a couple more. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Wait, should I do one more that's more varied? Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Hey, you're listening... Oh, wait, ready?
Yeah.
Hey, you're...
Sorry.
Okay. Alright, I'm gonna start in 3, 2, 1. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Touring in support of their critically acclaimed album, Walking in the Dark, Canadian Folk Music Award nominees Sweet Alibi come to Vancouver. Sweet Alibi with co-headliner Jada Kelly live at the Rogue Folk Club at St. James Hall on Thursday, November 10th. Get your tickets for this captivating show, an evening with two of Canada's fastest emerging artists at www.sweetalibi.com and www.darthjada.com. The East Van Go-Go's are pleased to announce a benefit concert and brunch Sunday, November 6th at the Trout Lake Community Center. Proceeds benefit the Grandmothers to Grandmothers Project of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, supporting African grandmothers who are raising children orphaned by AIDS. The event combines delicious home cooking and soul-stirring live performances from Illiterati. Seating is limited, so reserve a ticket now by emailing eastvangogos@gmail.com.
All right, you're listening to A Face for Radio coming in on the airwaves of CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver, BC, at the campus of the University of British Columbia. You may have noticed so far that my voice sounds a little different. Well, it has been a tough week for me. One of my wisdom teeth decided that it was time to start growing in. I'm 23 years old, so a little late, but generally a late bloomer. So I guess it makes sense. Today so far, I have not felt agonizing pain, more of just a numbness, but I also have not tried to eat anything. Yesterday and the day before, it was a lot of pain. Thankfully, they got some nice they're just drugs that you buy at Safeway or Shoppers Drug Mart. A thing called Orajel has been very helpful, but you can only use it 4 times a day. So I've been using that. However, it's been terrible to try and eat any food or to talk for too long. So thankfully, today we have the second part of the interview with Dan Levinson and Molly Ryan, two hot jazz superstars based in New York City. So that'll be coming up in a little bit. Hopefully we'll have time to play some other music. I don't know if we will, though, because I was applying for a job today in the morning and literally everything went wrong. I had everything prepared, and it could not have gone more south and taken more time than it did, but that's okay. Also, do you think I sound more like a stoned Sylvester the Cat or like Tweety Bird on Downers? That's sort of, I can't tell which one I sound like, so focus on the S's. Let me know, call in. But for now, we've got Molly Ryan and Dan Levinson here. The second part of the interview, I played the first part last week, and I hope you enjoy. All right, we'll be back in a bit. That brings me to a question for you, or actually for both of you. Both of you both play as band leaders and as, you know, the supporting cast, for lack of a better word. Is there a different way in which you approach the music, or when you are a part of the band, or as opposed to when you're leading the band?
That's a very good question. Yeah, and yes, right? Yeah, very much so.
Totally.
There are band leaders that don't know how to be sidemen, and there are sidemen that don't know how to be band leaders. A lot of them. The ideal musicians, the most well-rounded, you know, they time and again, right, can do both. You really need to know when just to be a sideman, when it's not, when your opinion is not necessary. Sometimes, you know, band leaders appreciate it. You know, what do you want to play? What are you in the mood for? And it's helpful if a guy says something more than, oh, I don't know, whatever you want to play. But if you've got a band with seven people in it and seven band leaders, you're going to have seven different ideas of what's supposed to happen. So if you have guys that fit their roles, a sideman who knows how to be a sideman or a band leader that knows how to be a sideman, you're better off. And we surround ourselves with those kind of people. And I don't tend to, when I'm a band leader, I don't hire band leaders that don't know how to be sidemen. And as a sideman, I really try to remember what my role is. And even if I disagree about how something is done, it's not my job unless the band leader asks me for my opinion. I keep my mouth shut. I remember that about 30 years ago when I was working for Dick Hyman, one of the great studio reed men, Phil Bodner, was for years and years, he was older than Dick Hyman, was on thousands of albums. And I came into a session, and he was playing lead alto. Lead alto generally sits in the middle of the section. Why? So the other saxophone players can hear him and blend with him. If he's all the way on one side of the section, then the guy on the other side can't hear him as well, or hear him at all. And he was playing lead alto, and the engineer had put him all the way on the left side of the saxophone section. And I said to him, Phil, why are you on the left? He says, well, that's where the engineer put me. And I said, but can you be in the middle? And he said, yes. And I said, well, why don't you say something? And he said, because it's not my session. And I mean, it's just a little thing he said to me, but I remembered that. I remembered how important this guy who had been doing what he'd been doing for 50, 60 years at that point, knew that it wasn't his job to change everything around. The engineer obviously had set it up that way for a reason, and he just let it go. So I can't say I'm always successful at that, but I aspire to be a good sideman when I'm working in somebody else's band. Molly, do you have any?
The demon child. She's been so good. No, our experiences are pretty similar with this kind of thing. I try to be very conscious of how I'm treating other people. That's what it's mainly about for me, is when I'm the band leader, I am consciously aware of how I'm treating my sidemen, and try not to micromanage. And when I'm a sideman, I try to do what the band leader wants me to do, even if it's not the way I would prefer to have things done.
Yeah, and for you to, because you play guitar as well, right?
Well, I...
Yeah, she does.
Is there a different approach?
I play rhythm guitar, and I do not profess to be very good. But a different approach No, I don't lead and play guitar. I play rhythm guitar in a few different bands, but I don't do it all the time. It's an occasional thing.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, I only have a couple more questions for you two. You've both mentioned in passing Boardwalk Empire, and I believe you're both featured on the soundtrack. So what was that like, and how did that come about?
And featured on a lot of Boardwalk Empire sessions, and for both of us, it's through Vince Giordano. I'm not quite sure how Vince became the vintage coordinator
Vince did the Aviator in 2003.
Right.
And I think it was
with Scorsese.
Yes. Also, that was the connection there.
Okay.
That's how we got Boardwalk Empire. So all the new music, that is to say, when they don't drop a needle and play an old recording, right, that's what the sounds of New York City, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
New York City.
Yeah. And we're in the apartment right now. That's how loud that is.
Oh, goodness.
I think it was Randall Poster who was the connection between Vince and The Aviator and Boardwalk Empire, so every time there's a new recording in Boardwalk Empire, it's Vince Giordano's Nighthawks, and
okay.
Vince was involved in the tune selection process as well, and also as a sort of an advisor to make sure that what they did was authentic. Because again, you know, like the German band leader I mentioned, Andre Hermlin, Vince is very much about doing everything in an authentic way, and his arrangements, his musicians, everything is handpicked to fit the style. So I'm a sideman, as I mentioned, Vince Giordano's band, and that was my connection. That's how I got on Boardwalk Empire.
And, of course, Vince knows me through Dan, and he's hired me to perform with the Nighthawks on several occasions. And I only was asked to do a couple tunes for season one. After season one and the show, when the show became really popular, they were only hiring pretty well-known artists. But I got very lucky that I was asked for season one before that, and we were on vacation when I got asked. We were in Hawaii, and I got an email from Vince asking if I could come in and do a couple numbers. So we cut our vacation short so that I could fly back, and we took a red eye back from Honolulu, landed in Newark around 5 or 6 a.m., and then I took a cab straight to the recording studio and recorded those two numbers that morning with just a pianist. And that was it.
Wow, that's pretty wild.
But I didn't want to turn down the opportunity to do that, so we made sure to get there in time for that.
That's commitment. What's it like playing music that's meant for the show? This is something that's interesting to me. I love film. I love music in movies and TV. Love TV. Boardwalk Empire is a great show. Just what's that like, making the music or playing the music for a program, as opposed to, you know, when you're just playing it for yourself or for a live audience or for a recorded album?
Yeah, it's different because when you're doing it for yourself, you're doing it the way that you know to do it and feels best. And when you're in the studio doing it for a movie or television show or whatever it is for, you're more like an actor. You've got your director, we'll call it the musical director, sitting in the booth, and they'll say, you know, that was good, but can you put a little bit more of this feeling into it? Or can you think about something sad while you're singing? Or can you smile when you sing? Because when you smile, people can actually hear that you're smiling. You know, they direct you through rather than you just doing your thing.
Interesting. That was interesting.
And they do that, and they do that for all the instruments too. You know, whether it's Dan on clarinet or it's a trumpet or trombone, they want them to make little noises here and there, little sounds, and you'll get one thing in, and they'll say, oh, could you make it squeak a little more, or could you make it a little lower? Could you add some vibrato to it? It's very much like being an actor and being directed.
That's interesting that you talk about, and they talk about being an actor there. That totally makes sense. But it's also how both of you, or how Dan said you both approach the music sort of theatrically as well, how that just has it's a part of the music, which is at least something that I don't always think about. But
right.
it's good to know.
We're thinking, well, for me, when he says we're using theatrics, it's mainly for me that I'm trying to convey the message of the song. So I'm listening to the lyrics and I'm listening to the story, and I have to tell that story. And obviously you have to tell it appropriately. You're not going to sing a sad song in a really happy manner, because that's not realistic. But when you're doing it for a show, a television show or a film, they're not really taking so much the lyrics into consideration as they're taking the scene and what's happening in that particular scene. And so your voice and the song need to match up with the feeling of the scene rather than the feeling of the song.
Oh, that's interesting. Cool. All right. I have just two more questions. Thank you both. It's been wonderful. I wanted to ask you, talked about two, people that you both, two, musicians that you both, play their music. So Benny Goodman and Django Reinhardt, when I was reading a bit about both of you, there's these two came up, and I want to ask about them because I like both of them a lot. What drew you both, or each of you, to these, or what draws you to each of these musicians? Because they're quite different as well.
I'm going to let Dan answer first, because those two artists in particular, he has more connection with. So give me the baby.
You take the baby.
I'll take the baby.
I'll take the phone. And it's not connected at all, other than the fact that they both play jazz, they both play swing, and they play during the same era. But my connection with Django Reinhardt is so different to my connection with Benny Goodman. Goodman was probably just heard his music. I really don't know at this point. I first heard Django, I know, when I was about 18, and I was at Tower Records in New York City, and they were playing his music in the jazz department while I was record shopping, and I heard that sound, chug, 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 in the violin. And that's the first time I heard that music. And then some years later, I went and lived in Paris and heard a lot of it there and started playing with one of those Django groups. We were playing on the street, and there were two guitars and a bass and me. And I learned a lot of the repertoire. But ever since I first heard it, and more so when I began to play it, I realized that the gypsy jazz has a very, it's a very unique sound, but it has a quality to it that you don't find in other jazz, certainly not as prominently, mm-hmm. and it comes from the fact that it is that it was created and originated by gypsies. These were gypsies that wandered through Eastern Europe, and you have the Eastern European influence in the way they interpret melodies, the use of all string instruments, violin and guitars, and the harmonies that they use. The way they hear music, the way they interpret music, is different from Benny Goodman, who grew up in Chicago, and swing music, which was born in the United States. So it's a real European aspect to the music, which gives it its flavor, and that's what has drawn me to it from the very beginning. And as I said, a violin in most cases, but I enjoy also the recordings that Django made with a clarinet player. Hubert Rostand replaced Django, replaced Stefan Grappelli in the Quintet de la Flamme de France after the war, and they made some wonderful recordings with clarinet. Oh. But even the earlier recordings, I like to interpret that was recorded originally with violin, I like to interpret those on clarinet. So I didn't have a lot of opportunity to do that, and 10 years ago, again, right around that crucial time and the turnover, I formed my own gypsy jazz band, which I now call Fête Manouche, because I didn't have opportunities to play it here. They were higher violinists, so yeah. I had to create my own band. And that's how that started. And when Molly started playing guitar shortly after that, I thought, well, here's a wonderful opportunity. Since I like to hear the words, we can make her the third guitarist in the ensemble and have her do the vocals. So that's how her involvement. She's now stepped out into the other room with the baby. So I'll let her comment on that shortly. In fact, you can compare our stories.
Okay.
They line up. To move on to Benny Goodman, when I first started playing, I had a mentor and friend whose name was Rosie McHarg. His first name was James, but his nickname was Rosie, R-O-S-Y. He was born in 1902, knew everybody. He was around Chicago in the 1920s and knew Benny Goodman personally at that time and recorded with Frank Trumbauer, heard Bix Beiderbecke perform many times in person. Wow. And Rosie was a guy I got to know in the 1980s. He himself, he was 83 years older than I was, and I met him he was born 63 years older than I was, and I met him while he was performing in Santa Monica, California, with his band. And he was in 1984 when I met him, so he was 82, and I was 19. And he took me under his wing, as he did for many people who played with him over the years. He had a lot of proteges, and I got to know him, and he was the one who introduced me to the music of Benny Goodman. I'd heard the name, but to me, you know, my father listened to big bands. I knew my father was had listened to the Benny Goodman Carnegie Hall Jazz Concert. That was his introduction to jazz, my father. So I'd heard the name Benny Goodman, but Rosie said Benny Goodman played the clarinet as well as it could be played. And I took those words to heart, and I really started to get into the music of Benny Goodman. And when I started studying clarinet, I was 20 years old. Wow. Rosie was a great influence on me, for sure. He didn't really give me lessons. I was living in New York. I was taking lessons in the beginning from a very young Ken Petlowski, who was not that much older than I am, but even then was a brilliant musician, and I respected his playing. And when I started taking lessons from him, he himself had really learned his style from Benny Goodman and then developed his own style. But one of his great influences was Benny also. So Petlowski had me learn some Benny Goodman solos. And it was every road seemed to lead to Benny Goodman. And I understand why now, all these years later. It didn't take me long, but in the beginning, you don't really know what's good and what isn't good, and somebody has to tell you, this is good clarinet playing. All right, so I got that sound in my ears, and now when I hear that sound, like, it's hard to describe what goes through me when I hear the sound of Benny Goodman's clarinet, but I recently heard another clarinetist who's Benny Goodman influenced clarinetist, Dave Bennett. Dave said, you know, when I hear Benny's clarinet, it makes me feel happy inside. And it's a very primal feeling. It's a very basic feeling, that feeling of happiness when you hear something. But that's exactly what it is. I don't get that from many musicians. I don't know that I get it just that way from any other musician, but when I hear the sound of his clarinet, there's something about it, the rhythmic feel, the way he swings, the way he creates a phrase, builds a solo. There's a dramatic aspect to it. You know, with Artie Shaw, you don't have, Artie Shaw can construct a beautiful, flawless, picture-perfect solo. But it doesn't always have the dramatic aspect that you get from Benny Goodman and Louis Armstrong, for that matter. Mm-hmm. When they make their way up to a high note at the very end of a solo, at the end of Benny's sing, sing, sing solo, when he goes up to the high concert A natural, he's worked his way up there. It's not just part of the phrase, as it might be in an Artie Shaw solo, like Stardust, where Artie plays the same note. It just makes it part of the phrase. But there is that real dramatic aspect, and I think that is one thing that draws me to his music, is that there is a heat and an intensity that I don't find in other players. And he was playing in 1920s and 30s, certainly in the 30s, with racially integrated bands. And of course, he himself was responsible for bringing Teddy Wilson and Lionel Hampton, and later on Charlie Christian, into his own band, and being the first major band leader to have an African-American musician as a regular member of the band. And I think there was a lot of interplay. I think he got a lot from the African-American culture and put that in his playing. There's a lot of soul in his playing that you don't hear in other players, and that's why he could fit in on a session with Teddy Wilson and Billie Holiday and sound like he was one of the cats. It's a difficult thing to explain, but there was so many facets to him as a musician. You know, of course, later on he became a legit clarinetist and played classical music. So he was well-trained, got a good sound, he played in tune, but he could also play with a real driving soul and could play the blues really, really well. So all of those things made Benny Goodman into what he was, and have influenced. It's hard to imagine any clarinetist not being influenced in some way by Goodman. And I hesitate to say it, but I know it's true. Even Artie Shaw, who made his first records about 1930, 4 years after Goodman did. And you hear that in Artie Shaw's early recordings. You hear Goodman. So that's how I got into it, and it's always been a part of me. I do not try deliberately to play like Benny Goodman. The hard part, after you've been influenced so deeply by somebody, is to jettison that, not try to sound like somebody else. In fact, you need to find your own voice as a musician. And that is our goal. Every one of us has to find who we are and create a voice so distinctive that when somebody hears four bars of Dan Levinson, they say, that's Dan Levinson. I don't think I'm there. But that is my ultimate objective. Hopefully, sometime before I leave the planet, I'll be able to say, oh, that's Dan Levinson. You certainly can do that with Benny Goodman, and you can do that with Django Reinhardt. You know it's them right away.
Yeah. It's also funny how you mentioned that you heard Django Reinhardt, because that's how I heard of him the same way. I was in a record store with my mom, and I was like, this is amazing. We asked the guy who it was and bought the CD on the spot, and that's how I was introduced to him. But, yeah, I just thought that was funny when you brought that up.
Like it, right? There's nothing else like Django. You know that sound, right? So the three guitars.
Yeah.
And violin, right? And the whole gypsy jazz movement, which is still prevalent all over the world,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't have happened without Django.
Yeah. I want to ask you real quick about playing with Leon Redbone, since we're talking about other people, other players.
Yep. I met Leon in 1990, or shortly there. I think I met him in 1989. I did my first tour with him in April 1990, and the second one with him in May of 1990. And then I went out and lived in Europe, and I lived in New Orleans. And when I came back to New York in 1993, I started working with him again and worked with him exclusively. I was on everything that I was available for, pretty much. I was on with him between 1993 and 2001, and then sporadic dates after that. Got another horn player, Scott Black, who came back after having been away. Scott was in the band for a while, but I continued to work occasionally. And I just saw him last month. I saw Leon. So, you know, we're still in touch. I wish he was retired, you know, at this point. I wish he was still performing. But that, to me, was something, again, totally different from what I did in the jazz world. And people who would come into the band thinking it was a jazz gig, it wasn't. It wasn't. It wasn't like anything else.
Yeah, it's very particular style.
Yeah, I mean, how do you describe what he did, the style of music that he played? Certainly influenced by the blues guitarist Blind Blake.
Yeah.
Great influence on him. But also the vaudevillians like Emmett Miller, who was more than anybody else responsible for shaping Leon Redbone into what he was. Emmett Miller also... various other vaudevillian performers. Somebody once constructed a family tree, a mock family tree, for Leon Redbone, with Redbone at the bottom, and then all of the different artists who had influenced him and created that. But it incorporated elements of certainly early jazz, ragtime, vaudeville, country music or early hillbilly, blues, and so many different genres that you can't really classify. Where did they put him in the days when they had record stores? What section was he in? Rock.
Yeah.
He was in rock. You know, the one thing he wasn't was a rock musician, but he was so popular on the pop circuit among young people through his appearances on Saturday Night Live in the 1970s that, you know, that's where they put him. Never made any sense to me, and I'm sure it made even less sense to him. But he's a very, very intelligent man. I mean, very well read, very articulate, and there was a certain aspect of his stage personality that is who he is in real life, but not entirely. It's a show.
Yeah.
And we worked things out. He didn't like things to happen the same way every night. We'll start by saying that. But it was a show, and there was a lot of ad-libbing going on. But there was also a certain line. We knew where that line was, and you didn't cross that line. The humor didn't work if you crossed that line.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about subtlety. He can sit there and tune his guitar string for 10 minutes and have the audience glued to their seats, watching his, just every time he raises an eyebrow, it gets a laugh, it gets some sort of reaction, because it's so much based on subtlety, and it was brilliant the way he could have an audience just hanging on his every movement as he tunes his guitar. People would come in who had never seen Leon Redbone, and they would say, he tuned his guitar for 10 minutes. You know, he sounded like he was warming up for some moment. What was all this other stuff that was happening between the songs? They don't realize that the stuff between the songs is really what the show is.
And yeah.
The music is just the incidental part that happens in between the other shtick. And we had a lot of routines that we've worked up that were based on the Emmett Miller thing or the Moran and Mac comedy sketches. Only the politically correct aspects of those, I should mention. We were very careful about that. But we worked out little routines that were from the vaudeville sketches on those records. Like, did you go to that? He says, I haven't been feeling well lately. And I say, did you go to that doctor I sent you to? And he says, yeah. I went to that man, but he didn't do me a bit of good. And I said, well, what did he tell you to do? He told me to take a milk bath. A milk bath? Yeah. And I say, well, did you take one? I took one, but it didn't do me a bit of good. And I said, well, was it pasteurized? And he said, oh, behave yourself. It only came up to here. He said, that man knew what I had coming in and going out. And I said, what'd you have going out? And he said, going out, I didn't have a thing. I said, well, what'd you have coming in? I had $52. The types of things we did, we worked out. It was all part of the show.
Yeah.
But and I really tried to be a good straight man for all those years, but because he was so into ad-libbing and doing different stuff every night, he would it seemed like he intentionally would try to make something go wrong.
Oh, yeah.
There'd always be some moment during the show when I would lose it, and that seemed to be where the audience really appreciated what was happening, because it was real. I was never pretended to lose it. Something would happen, and it would just, I remember we were in Oregon. I can tell you, I'm good with dates. It was January 1997. Oh, hang on, turn that off. It was January 1997. We were in Oregon, and it was 30 degrees below zero outside. 30 below zero.
Jeez.
We're in, and all the stuff, all the equipment had been in the van overnight.
Oh, man.
And obviously not his guitar. He brought his guitar into the hotel room. But we went and did the show the next day, and he had this little stick he did with one of those bubble wands, you know, where he'd take the wand out and hold it up to the fan, and the fan would blow the bubbles out. And the pianist tonight, pianist was Tom Roberts. Although he wasn't on that, I don't think it was just Redbone and me, and Scott Black was on that date. And so Redbone did his usual stick, and we went into I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles like we always did, and nothing happened. We were waiting and waiting, and he's holding the wand up, and no bubbles. And we did another chorus, and we did a third chorus, still no bubbles. And finally, he pushes the microphone off to the side and leans over to me, and he says, they're frozen. so we had a lot of moments like that over the years. It was a lot of fun being on the road with him and getting into his groove. Because it wasn't like anything else I'd ever done in my life. And the showbiz aspect of it was always enticing and exciting for me because of my interest in the theater and my training as an actor.
Well, that was great. Thank you for that story. I guess I just... one last question I have to ask both of you. Because, you know, I'm in Vancouver, and found out, when I saw you play was at the Rum House, and that was because Evan Arntzen, who's a clarinetist and sax player from Vancouver, who's now based in New York, happened to run into him earlier that night, showed it, and told us about the show that was going on. So, are there any Vancouverites out, any more Vancouverites out in New York City, in the Mecca, and you know, how are they doing if they're there?
Who else is there in Vancouver?
I know there are a lot of musicians from the area, maybe not necessarily Vancouver, but Bria Skanberg is from Chilliwack.
Oh, wow.
So that's Vancouver. She's there. And then Sean Cronin, bass player, also from that area, I think.
Certainly British Columbia. And, I just don't know.
Yeah, and Seattle, too. A bunch of displaced musicians from the Seattle area, like Mike Davis, great cornet player that I've been working with a lot. He was new on the scene and really great hot player from Seattle, I think. And Emily Asher, also from Seattle area, and Glenn Kreitzer, guitarist, banjoist from that area. And perhaps soon Evan's brother,
Arnt
Arntzen,
who
may be moving to New York.
Well, it's nice to hear that there's some representation from the Pacific Northwest over there.
Quite a bit. Yeah, I guess there are no musicians left in Seattle and British Columbia right now.
Yeah, well, luckily we still have a few.
We had one come to our jazz camp. You know, Bria Skanberg and I, we started an adult jazz camp this year. It was our first year. Next year we're having it again.
Oh, wonderful.
Called the New York Hot Jazz Camp, and we're going to have a youth camp next year as well. And we had a young trombone player.
Oh, Sky.
Sky Lamborn. I don't know if you know who he is. He's from Vancouver.
No, but I might have heard him play.
Part of a young scene out there, and apparently, we have friends, Michelle and Sam. Can't remember last names right now, but they started a weekly jam session in Vancouver.
Okay.
We should find out where that is and give you that info.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'd love to share it on the show.
Michelle DeCastro and Sam Huang, right?
Yeah, Sam. Yep. See if I can find him. H-U-A-N-G. Sam Huang.
I'm not sure where that jam is, but we'll find out.
Well, that'd be great. Thank you. And thank you both so much for taking some time out of your day to chat. Here with me, and thanks to the baby for her slight appearances on the show. Pleasure to have her.
Yes, she just fell asleep in my arms actually. So
wonderful.
Thank you. I'm glad that the album has brought you some enjoyment and that it's doing what we wanted it and hoped it would do, which is bring joy to people.
Well, on that note, I think that's a great way to end it, and hopefully the interview will bring joy to some people too. It's been a joy to talk to both of you, and thanks again.
Likewise, Eric.
Thank you, Eric. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for keeping the music alive.
Yep. All right. Well, have a good one, and we'll hopefully see you in Vancouver sometime soon.
Sounds good.
All right.
Yep. Stay in touch, all right?
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks very much.
Thursday, November 10th. Come out for a night ranging from pensive reflection to cacophonous beauty at the Emerald Cabaret. Off of the recent release of her album Objet A, Victoria's Old Girl joins locals Ichuda and Failing. Tickets are $7 at the door.
All
right. That was the second part of my interview with Dan Levinson and Molly Ryan. Up next, we got Rockin' from Russia. This has been Face for Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. Enjoy. Have a good day.